welcome to Aerium Britannia. Today's date is Monday the 16th of December 2019, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting at RadioAlbion.com. Well, what an exciting episode we have for you today after the exciting election results on Friday, and who better to discuss it with than Max Musson from Western Spring. Max, good afternoon to you, sir. How are you doing?
Good afternoon to you. I'm doing fine, actually. I've got a slightly croaky voice that your listeners might be able to pick up on. Just the tail end of a sort of cold or flu kind of thing that I normally shake off after a few days. So I'm not feeling quite as chipper as I normally do, but not too bad.
Yeah, and there was me thinking you were hungover from celebrating all weekend all these Ramona MPs that have been kicked out of office. I mean, this was just absolutely glorious to see. The Hope Not Hate MP, she's gone. Luciana Berger, famous for locking up young nationalists for making bad jokes about her, she's gone. Sam Guyamar, he's gone. Dominic Grieve, he's gone. Anna Soubry, she's gone. The looks on their faces was just absolutely priceless. Labour have been absolutely slaughtered. I mean, even in Wales, which was quite a stronghold for them, they've lost between a quarter and a third of their seats in Wales. The Conservatives have taken all of North Wales, basically. And if you actually add the votes that went to the Conservatives and the votes that went to the Brexit Party, actually more people voted for them than did vote for Labour. And of course, the actual Brexit vote in Wales was overwhelming. Something like, I think I wrote it down here. Where did I write it down? Yeah, 17 counties in Wales voted to leave the European Union, and 5 counties voted to stay. And yet the Labour Party, who were the main party in power, basically, in Wales, they just tried to sabotage it. And so, of course, they've lost all these seats that they had before. I've got a theory about the Conservative Party that I'll probably get into a little bit later, because I have discussed this a bit on Friday. So really, what are your thoughts on this election, Max? Let's begin with that.
Okay, I think the primary reason for Labour losing as catastrophic as they did was that Jeremy Corbyn steadfastly refused to adopt a position one way or the other with regard to Brexit, and so therefore was able to be portrayed by the media as being dithering and incapable of making a decision on the subject. I don't think that's quite fair. I think, as far as he's concerned, he was trying to adopt this sort of position where he was above the referendum result, and so where he would be prepared, in the event of Labour being elected, to sit back and be an impartial facilitator of whatever the result, whatever the majority of people within the public wanted once they had the second referendum. But I think that, as far as the vast majority of public were concerned, that they didn't want a second referendum. I think even people who are Remainers, by and large, a very large proportion of Remainers, were so, by the time the election was held, were so sick and tired of all the wrangling over Brexit that they just wanted to get it over with and done, and didn't really care which way it turned out. And so he made the mistake of putting himself in a position where he could be portrayed, as I say, as being dithering, of not wanting what the vast majority of the public wanted, and he's paid the price for that. I think the secondary factor that's been involved has been the fact that he has been the victim of a continual smear campaign for probably the last 4 years, where various individuals within the Jewish community have just waged a campaign, and it's been various members of parliament, some of them within his own party, that have got connections with the Jewish community, have just waged this smear campaign portraying the Labour Party as being absolutely riven with anti-Semitism, and portraying Jeremy Corbyn as being this sort of incompetent leader who just lets it happen, which I think, again, was a very unfair thing, because if you look at Jeremy Corbyn, I don't think he has actually ever said anything which could be unequivocally described as anti-Semitic. I think that as far as the International Holocaust Remembrance Society, or whatever they're called, definition of anti-Semitism is concerned, I think as far as that is concerned, then he has obviously criticised the government of Israel, and so therefore, according to that definition, he perhaps could be seen as being anti-Semitic, but I don't think he's actually said anything which is out and out anti-Semitism at all. And in fact, he's said lots of things which are the opposite of that, where he has said things that are quite generous to the Jewish community. I mean, one of the things that I've looked at in the past has been the occasion in 2015, October 2015, which was the very first Labour Party conference, and I've mentioned this before, the very first Labour Party conference after Jeremy Corbyn became the leader of the Labour Party, and he made a speech at the Labour Friends of Israel and was then heckled. And this was probably the beginning of the really overt smear campaign against him, because he I'll just read you
it was just because he didn't mention Israel in his speech, wasn't it? I mean, it was something quite pathetic, really, just because he didn't actually mention Israel, from what I That's remember right. from what I remember. But I don't think the public didn't vote for him because because he'd been accused of being an anti-Semite. I think it was to do with the people that were calling him an anti-Semite having control of the press and smearing him in every which way they possibly could. And I think that had more to do with it, because I don't think the public are that concerned about 2% of the population and how Jeremy Corbyn feels about this tiny percentage of the population. But they are concerned when they see him constantly being smeared for other issues and just being made out to be a terrible bad guy that supports the IRA, supports Hamas, all this sort of stuff, and just constant negativity in the media. And I do think that had an effect on him. I also think that it really shows you just how out of touch these people are in thinking that the general public wanted Brexit to be sabotaged and frustrated. We don't. And it was wonderful to see John Bercow and the look on his face, because he'd been invited onto Sky News to discuss the election results. And as they were coming in, I mean, his jaw just dropped. And this is a guy that's supposed to be a conservative, remember, and he thought he had the public on his side. So both of those things, I think they got badly wrong. But one thing I really did want to ask you about, Max, is because you predicted quite a while back that this would happen, that Labour would lose and it would be down to the Jews with their bad publicity attacking him. And then you predicted that we might well see a backlash against them, with the Labour supporters saying, well, it was the Jews that lost us this vote. Do you see any sign of that happening? Do you think that may still happen?
Well, there's already been a couple of articles in the newspapers over the weekend where prominent Jews have been saying that they are preparing themselves for the backlash, implying that any backlash that comes will be further evidence of anti-Semitism within the Labour Party, rather than the Labour supporters being incensed over the fact that Jeremy Corbyn was so relentlessly attacked. And yes, I agree with what you say. I don't think the public have been concerned about the anti-Semitism, but the anti-Semitism has enabled, the accusations of anti-Semitism has enabled the media, and has been it has encouraged the media to attack Jeremy Corbyn in a way which is unfair. And you've only got to look at the interview that Jeremy Corbyn had with Andrew Neil, where Andrew Neil got onto the subject of anti-Semitism within the Labour Party, and then just basically went for Jeremy Corbyn's jugular and just didn't relent for a very large part of the interview, until a point had been reached where Jeremy Corbyn was kind of reeling from the attack, and Andrew Neil was, you know, really quite proud of what he'd done. But it prevented Corbyn from actually presenting the Labour Party's policies at all, or, you know, to any effective degree. And again, you know, that was one of the one of the things that was, you know, illustrative of the kind of actions taken by the media that then led to the Labour Party losing. But it's as you say, it's a situation where the where those people in Westminster, those people within the media, have had completely different opinions to the opinions held by the vast majority of the public. And so whilst on the one hand, we had a situation where the majority of the British people wanted us to exit the European Union, but a majority of MPs didn't want it and then did everything they possibly could to stand in the way. And on the other hand, we had a situation where the majority of the members of the Labour Party wanted Jeremy Corbyn to be the leader of the Labour Party, but a majority of Labour MPs didn't want him to be the leader of the Labour Party. And that was largely as a result of these accusations that were made against him of anti-Semitism. And so they decided fairly quickly after he'd been elected leader of the Labour Party that they were going to challenge him for the leadership. And so there was this challenge that came through with I can't think of the name of the guy who challenged him now, but there was a very early challenge to Corbyn's leadership of the Labour Party, which then illustrated that there was a disconnect between what the majority of Labour Party members wanted and what the actual parliamentary Labour Party wanted. And it exactly mirrors the disconnect between the British public and what the British public wanted to do with regard to Europe and what the members of Parliament, the majority of the members of Parliament wanted. It was exactly the same thing.
Yeah, it's the Labour members, they all support Corbyn and they think he's great. But the rest of the general public don't. The policies that he's putting forwards about transsexuals and ethnic minorities and forcing through teaching in schools of compulsory white guilt lessons, that may appeal to the Labour members, the Antifa, but it doesn't appeal to the general public. I mean, right after this election, there were riots in London, Antifa riots, and they all had these pre-made up placards from the Socialist Worker, not my Prime Minister, all this sort of nonsense. They were fighting with the police, they were letting off flares, and you know, this is a landslide win in the election. The Conservatives won by 80 seats, a massive win by them, a massive lose by Labour. This is democracy, the people have spoken, and yet these sore losers on the left think that they have some right to speak for the general public and to go out there rioting. It's like they live in a complete fantasy world. They just cannot understand that Boris Johnson is the guy that the working classes wanted. You know, they don't understand that. They think that the working classes should be associated with, you know, associating with people from South America. Well, they don't. They associate with white people. The white working class associate with white people. I think what we're seeing here is Labour Party has become the party of the immigrants, the party of the foreigners, and the Conservative Party are becoming the party of the British people and the people that want to stay in Britain. And this is what I wanted to say about the Conservatives. If you look back at the last two elections, you have David Cameron, who had to rule in a coalition with the Liberal Democrats. He got such a small amount of votes there. And what did he do? He brought in gay marriage. He tried to push himself as a progressive. And then you have Theresa May, who was put in there, and she pushed herself as a feminist progressive, and she didn't get enough votes to win by a majority. She had to go into coalition with the DUP. So the general public were saying, we're not happy with this. We're not happy with these progressive politics. Then you get Boris Johnson, who the mainstream media have portrayed as a fascist. We've had David Lammy calling him a Nazi and a white supremacist. And it's been pushed that he's going to push the Conservative Party to the far right. And what happens? They win with a landslide. They get 80 seats. Now, the Conservative Party are all about getting votes. I mean, we say they don't have an ideology. There's nothing behind them. All they're interested in is getting votes. Now, I do hope that that is true. And they realize this, that in order to get votes, in order to get voted in, they need to move to the right. And I am hoping and praying that that they realize this. The their advisors probably won't tell them this, because their advisors were telling Theresa May, oh, yes, you should have an election. You're strong and stable, and Brexit means Brexit, and you'll win. And she lost, and she sacked all her advisors. Well, she didn't lose. She didn't get a majority, and she sacked all her advisors. And I'm hoping Boris Johnson is a little bit cleverer than that. And if his advisors start trying to tell him he should be progressive, he sacks them, because it's the general public do not want progressive politics. We want populism. And that's why he won. So I think this is very positive, Max. And I think we could see the Conservatives move to the right because of that. What do you think of that?
I personally wouldn't hold my breath. I think as far as Boris is concerned, he's now got a very fat majority, which means he can pretty much do whatever he wants for the next 5 years. And unless he does something really badly over that five-year period so that it outweighs the capital that he has with the British public, he's probably going to win the next general election, because it will take a lot to wipe out an 80-seat majority. If Labour have a turnaround and start to be a bit smarter in terms of the way they campaign, and the Conservatives do behave in a way which is betrayal of the things that you've been saying, then that they may lose, say, 40 of their majority next time round, and they may lose the other 40 the time after that. But it looks pretty much as though Boris Johnson's going to be here for probably at least one, probably two, five-year parliamentary sessions, and he can pretty much do what he wants, I think. And what we need to find out, really, and what we need to think about is, you know, how has Boris behaved in the past? Has he been a kind of a nationalistic conservative, or has he been a liberal conservative? And the indications tend to be that he's more of a liberal conservative. And I think he said the things that he felt he needed to say in order to get himself a large majority. And whether he follows through on that, I don't know. I've always been of the opinion that it's not what politicians say that counts, but it's what they do when they're in power that counts. So we need to just sort of wait a little while to see what Boris does now, once he's in power with a significant majority.
Well, he is the only one that actually spoke about limiting migration. I mean, he talked about having this points-based system based on what they have in Australia. He said there would be strict limits on unskilled migration. There would only be short-term visas that were issued for short-term migration. And that's not enough. I mean, everybody wants a stop to immigration. The landslide Brexit vote, 17.4 million people, that was a proxy vote to say we don't want immigration. But people just felt like they couldn't say that because they would get accused of being racist. And I think we've got the same thing happening now again. They're the only party that have talked about putting any limits on immigration, and they've won a landslide with 80 seats. I mean, Theresa May didn't do anything about this. I mean, the left might have said, oh, she created a hostile environment. But there were masses of people that came in under Theresa May, even more people than came in the year before. They might have sent two or three black guys back from the Windrush generation, but that's nothing. You know, we need to have a halt to all the immigration. That's generally what people want. We've seen with the survey that Mark Collette and Laura Towler did, the We Were Never Asked survey, that showed that 60 or 70% of the general population do not want to become a minority by the year 2060. And something needs to be done about that. And we need politicians that are going to be representing those people, the majority of us that don't want immigration. And I think that played into this. I think that's one of the reasons why people voted for them. So we just have to see what happens, because he has spoken before about giving an amnesty to illegal immigrants. And that was brought up a month back, wasn't it? And people weren't happy. Sorry, go on, Max.
But if we look at what he's done over the European Union, he began by saying that that no deal was better than a bad deal. And he reiterated that statement, and he then gave the impression that he was going to give a very limited period of time to campaign negotiate a Brexit deal, and that if a Brexit deal wasn't forthcoming, then he was going to leave without a deal, and yet he shrank back from leaving without a deal. And I think that he may well do the same kind of thing over immigration. You know, he adopted a hard position over Brexit because he knew that was what was popular. Made a few noises with regard to immigration because he knows that's what's popular. But, you know, is he prepared to do anything about it? If he had a history of speaking up about against mass immigration in the past, then I'd feel more strongly in support of what you're saying. But if he had had a history of speaking out against the European Union prior to 2016, then I would have been more inclined to believe that he might now go back to the European Union and say, look, I've got a massive majority now, and, you know, we don't really want to have to accept the very little more than Brexit in name only deal that I managed to negotiate before when I had my hands tied behind my back, and now we're going to have a harder Brexit.
I think we could do. We could have a harder one.
That certainly could happen, but whether it will or not is we'll have to wait and see.
I think we could still end up getting a no deal Brexit, because I mean now that he's got this mandate behind him, and that is what he was threatening to do, and then he managed to get a deal, and then he was forced to beg for an extension from the EU because of the state of the Houses of Parliament without him having a majority. But now that he has a majority, if they start putting some changes in to that withdrawal bill, if they say, for instance, we want more control over our fisheries, say, or something like that, and the EU say, well, we're not prepared to do that, then Boris can say, well, I've got the mandate now. We'll just leave with no deal. And he could still hold that threat over them, because don't forget, they've only got an extension till January the 31st, and he is not going to want to get an extension again. So if there is problems over this, then we could still be leaving with no deal. The other factor of this, I think, is Nigel Farage, who really, I think, did a very good thing by standing down his Brexit politicians in the areas where they were up against the Conservatives. I think that has really helped, and keeping his Brexit guys in those places where they were going to take votes away from the Labour Party. I mean, if you look at Wales, the Brexit Party took 5% of the vote, and that was all from the Labour Party. All from the Labour Party that they took that away from. So I think we can thank Nigel Farage for this. I mean, perhaps Boris might like to do something for Nigel Farage. Perhaps he might like to put him in the House of Lords, where he could actually have some effect on legislation and on helping Brexit actually get through. I mean, there's all these things that he can do now that he couldn't do before. I'm fairly optimistic about this. Are you optimistic about it, Max, or are you pessimistic about it?
I wouldn't say that I'm optimistic or pessimistic. What I would say is that I think we just need to wait and see, because as far as Boris is concerned, you know, he's only very recently come to the fore and become the leader of the Conservative Party. He's been saying a lot of the right things, but it still remains to be seen what he actually intends to do. And as I say, I think I'll be feeling a lot more optimistic in the way that you are if I had seen a consistent pattern of Boris prior to 2016 speaking out against the European Union, and had I seen a consistent pattern of him talking out against mass immigration. Now, he has spoken a little bit about the points-based system for immigration, but I seem to recall a statement that he made where it was kind of implied that he wasn't necessarily going to limit immigration. He was just going to control it. And so it was a matter that it's not that they were going to just let anybody in, but they were only going to let in people that he thought were good enough. And if there happened to be lots of those people, then that wouldn't necessarily be a problem.
Yeah, that is a concern. That is a concern. We'll, as you say, we'll just have to wait and see what happens there. The other thing is who's going to replace Jeremy Corbyn? I mean, I'm really hoping it's going to be someone like Dawn Butler or Diane Abbott. They're talking about it being the little blonde girl with the double-barreled surname, who I think will, again, she will just be absolutely awful, and she will just lose the Labour Party votes. They're also talking about Keir Starmer, and he's quite a capable person, but he's actually the guy that's responsible for changing the Crown Prosecution Service guidelines to get them to believe a minority that claims to be a victim, even when they don't have any evidence. He changed these guidelines. He's the one that is responsible for these things called hate incidents now, which is where there isn't enough evidence to show that there's actually a crime, but the police still investigate it anyway and record it. And there's a court case going on at the moment with an ex-policeman that's having a judicial review, basically, of these hate incident laws. And that's what they go back to. They go back to Keir Starmer interfering with these guidelines. I mean, it actually led to that guy that was accusing all these top brass of being child molesters, and it turned out that actually he was the child abuser, and there was no evidence to support this, and yet Tom Watson spoke about it in Parliament, and they spent millions of pounds on this investigation, and it was all absolutely fruitless because the guy was just making all of this stuff up. But they had to believe him, and they had to investigate it because he was a minority victim. He had this victim status. So maybe that's going to change, but that's the sort of thing that Keir Starmer dreams up. So he's really no better than the rest of them. I saw John McDonnell on Andrew Marr, and they've really got to get rid of him. He is just so insincere. Every word that comes out of his mouth, he just looks like he's lying. I heard him the other day. He was saying, oh, I've made it my life's mission now to save the planet, and I've got to stop this climate change. And you just think, you know, he's just jumping on the bandwagon, jumps on every bandwagon that he can. He was there saying today, oh, yes, I take this on my shoulders. This is my fault. But, and making all these excuses. And you just think, you know, that's not an apology because the words don't mean anything. He's just so shallow. He just looks like a liar to me every time he opens his mouth. What do you make of him, Max? John McDonnell?
I thought he might be somebody who might be a contender to take over after Jeremy Corbyn, particularly if the Momentum group within Labour still hold the initiative, because they're going to want somebody who's going to be as similar to Jeremy Corbyn as possible. However, whether that turns out to be the case is anybody's guess at the moment. I think I agree with you that there is actually a dearth of talent in terms of people that could take over the running of the party. I don't see it, to be quite honest. I mean, I'm not an advocate of Jeremy Corbyn by any means, but it would be difficult to actually find somebody within the Labour Party who actually would be a better leader than he has been. You know, he hasn't been a particularly good leader. He's been a fairly weak leader in terms of facing up to the attacks against the Labour Party. There isn't anybody that looks like they're better quality than he is. You know, so it's a very sad situation for the Labour Party, I think. I think that they're going to be in the doldrums for quite a long period of time. I mentioned earlier that it looks as though Boris is going to be in position. Is going to retain the prime ministership for some considerable time to come. And I think that unless the Labour Party can really get their act together and find some fresh talent that are able to come to the fore, then that's going to play into that even more so.
And of course, Jo Swinson, she was wiped out as well, wasn't she? Jo Swinson,
that's right,
lost her seat. That was hilarious, and totally wiped out in Wales. I think they got an MP in September, the first MP they'd had in Wales for quite some time, and then that MP lost her seat in this election. I wasn't expecting it to be so much fun. I mean, we really weren't that interested in this election, were we? You know, it really doesn't matter who wins. Neither of them is really going to do what we want them to do. And yet the actual election night itself, just seeing all these people losing their seats and seeing Labour get trounced like that was was hilarious. I was just in such a great mood the next day. I was watching the Hope Not Hate MP, Ruth Smith or Smythe, whatever her name is. I was watching her on repeat as she was finding out that she'd lost her seat. The look on her face was priceless. You know, lots of moments reminiscent of when Trump won in America and all the Clintonistas were bursting into tears. It was a similar sort of thing on the Friday during the day. Yes. So yeah, we'll just keep following it and see what happens. I don't know if you want to add any more on that, Max, before we move into our Greatest Britons segment.
Oh, just one of the statistics that I thought was quite interesting, which is that the Conservative share of the vote only went up by a very small amount, but it made a massive difference in terms of the number of seats they won. I think their share of the vote actually only went up by something like about 1.4%, whereas the Labour Party's share of the vote overall fell by around about 8%, and that resulted in them getting a lot less MPs. And so I thought that was quite interesting because it, you know, when you talk about there being a landslide victory, you always think that the landslide victory has been caused by large numbers of people flocking to the side that won, whereas what's actually happened is that large numbers of people have just flocked away from the side that lost.
Right, right. And I was thinking, and also it shows that, you know, sometimes it can just be, you know, 100 or so people that actually makes the difference and pushes that party over the winning line. You know, I thought that as well. It doesn't really seem like that many more people have actually voted. It's been quite a small margin in these seats where they won. But yeah, as I say, lots of fun anyway. Lots of fun, and very pleased to see all that happen on Friday. Well, we started last week on our Alfred the Great series, our latest Greatest Britain. So we'll get back into that today. We did, I think, make a mistake last week when we were talking about Guthrum, the Viking king that was baptized by Alfred and then became the king of the Danelaw. And I think we suggested that he might have passed away shortly after. That's not entirely correct. He actually lived for another 12 years. He reigned as the king of the Danelaw, and he was a very loyal supporter of Alfred. So I just wanted to correct that. And last time we spoke about Alfred's early life. We spoke about his defeats and his final victory against the Vikings, which led to the Danelaw in the north and England in the south, which resulted in peace at last. And Alfred was able to start rebuilding the civilization. And that's where we got to last time. Finally, the Danes started settling the land and working in an agricultural life instead of piracy, but Alfred still had to contend with other attempts made at sea by Vikings not aligned with Guthrum. Now that there was peace, he set to work repairing London and inviting scholars from Europe to help educate himself and his people. He reinforced the defences, and the next time the Vikings came, they found a standing mobile field army, a network of garrisons, and a small fleet of ships navigating the rivers and the estuaries. So that you had the start of a navy there, and he built burhs or boroughs by repairing the defences, digging the ditches, and then connected the strongholds together by roads. And all the Angles and the Saxons could then survive if the Vikings turned up, because they could all steam inside this burr. And if they were put under siege, these reinforcements could then travel by road to the rescue. I think we might have mentioned that last week as well, Max, these burrs that he built. Do you want to make any comments on that at all?
Well, one of the other things that occurred to me was the building of the navy that Alfred did, which is where there was a specialised kind of fighting that was developed by him. And I've mentioned it before when we were talking about Lord Nelson, I think, that ships of the line would come alongside each other and would blast each other with their cannon, and then both sides would then throw grappling hooks over to pull the two ships together, and then their armies, or the marines that they would have rather on each of the boats, would then fight, and the winning side would then capture the other side's ship. Well, that form of fighting was something that was pioneered during the time of Alfred, And whereas the Vikings had ships that were quite wide, relatively speaking, with a very low draft, and that was to enable them to sail up rivers a long way and to sail in very shallow water. Once they came out to sea, then the ships that Alfred had built, which had a deeper draft and so therefore more stable in deeper water, particularly when the weather when it was windy and stormy. But then they also had the advantage having the deeper draft because the sides of the ship were higher, which then meant that when they came alongside a Viking ship, they were above the Vikings, and they developed the technique of using grappling hooks to pull the ships together so that they could jump into the Viking ships and defeat the Vikings. And so I think that was a significant factor in the way in which those ships were designed.
Yeah, you sort of wonder where he got the idea from, because it was credited with Arthur that he came up with this idea for changing the ships. But also when once the peace came and he started rebuilding London in particular, he started inviting over all these engineers, architects, craftsmen, very, very skilled people from the continent, where he had friendly relations with Charlemagne and the king that came after Charlemagne. So he borrowed craftsmen from the continent to come over to London and help rebuild the city. And at the same time, maybe he got some help from them, but he is actually credited himself with coming up with this design for the boats. In 896, he ordered the construction of a small fleet, perhaps a dozen or so longships that at 60 oars were twice the size of the Viking warships. 897 clearly marked an important development in the naval power of his kingdom, as the author of the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle related that Alfred's ships were larger, swifter, steadier, and rowed higher in the water than either the Danish or the Frisian ships. So they were a big success. And, you know, you do wonder where he got the knowledge, where he got the skills from to become a shipwright in designing these ships. I mean, that is a legend, isn't it, that Alfred actually designed these ships, and that was the first navy we had, I think, Max.
Yes, I think that I haven't got the notes in front of me, but I remember reading quite recently that he did go and study naval principles and things on the continent somewhere. I think he may have gone to Paris, or may have gone to I don't know, Rome perhaps even, and studied warfare at sea and the various designs of ships. And so it may be that this is learning that was from classical times.
We've always been an island. So I think we've always had ships. I don't think it can have been the first navy that we had, but it was certainly a leap forward in ship design. And also, he didn't actually have to go that far to find some of these craftsmen, because he went into Wales to get Bishop Asser. And details of his life are described in a work, or sorry, details of Alfred's life are described in a work by 9th century Welsh scholar and Bishop Asser, who he politely requested move to England to help instruct the Saxons. And this actually shows that the Welsh had a separate kingdom to the Saxons that was culturally more advanced than the Saxons, and also with a far older and more established church. I mean, apparently there was nobody actually in London who could even write Latin anymore. And we've got records of the time that show that the people back then couldn't write legible Latin. But in Wales, they had these monks there and these scholars there, and Alfred went to them. In actual fact, South Wales became not actually part of the Anglo-Saxon kingdom, but became allied with them. And Alfred actually had a lot of diplomatic missions and got on well with a lot of people, and particularly well with South Wales, and particularly well with this Bishop Asser. And originally Asser said, well, I'll come and stay with you for 6 months of the year, and then I'll have to go back to Wales to my diocese for the other 6 months. And then he was struck down ill, I think, for a year or two. And once he had recovered, then he moved to London, and he was with King Alfred all the time. And he was writing down his life. He was also reading out literature to King Alfred. I mean, these podcasts that we make now, I mean, people can just listen to these podcasts while they go about their work, while they go out and have a walk, while they're driving or whatever. And we just take it for granted that we can hear things that people say, we can hear conversations, we can hear audio books. And I like to think of King Alfred doing the same thing, only he actually had this bishop there, this Bishop Asser, who would be reading out the books that he wanted to be read out while he was doing whatever it was he was doing. So he could be continually learning all the time while he was working on other things, almost like having, you know, sort of Radio 4 playing all the time. He'd have this bishop that was reading out literature, reading out the classics. He was all about improving learning, and not just for himself, but improving learning for all the Saxons and for all his people. He really put his people at the forefront of everything. He saw himself as God has made me king, and to show my gratitude to God, I need to shepherd my flock. He was a very pious man. And just to reiterate this point, I mean, the fact that he could go to Wales and get this bishop there who had a fully functioning monastery, had a fully functioning bishopric, had all the scrolls and all the teachings and the whole system. This shows that the church was long established in Britain, a long time before Augustine came here in the 6th century. And it shows that despite the Saxons coming in and displacing the original Britons into Wales, once the Britons were in Wales, they were more civilized than actually the Saxons were. But they treated them as brother Christians and went in there to help them rebuild London. Have you got any comments on Bishop Asser, who wrote the life of King Alfred, Max?
No, I've not actually looked at what Bishop Asser has written, and it's very interesting what you say. And I think that it all tends to make sense that Wales, being the westernmost part of the UK, would have been the least affected by the raids of the Vikings, and so therefore would have benefited from the peace that would have prevailed more greatly in that area than prevailed over the rest of England. And I think that it's a principle worth bearing in mind that peace does bring with it prosperity, because people are able to apply the proceeds of their life's work to making life better, and that war is generally not in the interests of the vast majority of people, and a wise ruler tries to steer clear of entering into any wars, and certainly doesn't get involved in wars that are unnecessary or get involved in other people's wars.
Well, yeah, Alfred was just all about defence. And if you look back and you read the history of Britain from the Brute, the Chronicles of England, or if you look at Geoffrey of Monmouth's History of the Kings of England, it becomes quite apparent that a lot of the old British kings would go out on the warpath. I mean, they were quite similar to the Danes. They would go out and try and take over countries. And there's Belinus and Brennus that went and took over Rome. They were going over to France and kicking French butt, as it were. But then when you get to Alfred the Great, I mean, he didn't go out and prosecute any wars. All he did was defend his country, and he was magnanimous in victory by baptizing Guthrum, which obviously had this big influence on Guthrum, and he became, as I say, a loyal supporter of King Alfred. And Bishop Asser wrote the life of King Alfred, and that's the main source that we have for him. We also have the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, which just basically records everything that happened at that time. Interestingly, there's a big gap in the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, and that's actually when King Arthur was reigning, because he did defeat the Saxons for about 30 years, and there's a gap in the chronicle. But Bishop Asser mainly wrote about King Alfred's life, and he wasn't actually called King Alfred the Great at the time. That came about much later, but it is an authentic document that we have from the 9th century that was written by this Welsh scholar. And of course, alongside religion comes the law code, and Alfred had a reputation as a learned and merciful man, being of a gracious and level-headed nature, who encouraged education for all, insisting that all judges must be able to read, and proposing that primary education be conducted in English rather than Latin. And he insisted that judges had to learn to read, and if they weren't able to actually learn to read, then they would lose their role as judges. And he used to actually sit in there in the law courts to make certain that if you were rich or poor, you would be judged equally. And again, there's another legend that he hanged 100 judges for corruption. So he was very, very, very hot on law, and also the actual laws that the country had. And he improved the legal system, codifying the ancient Welsh uses of the island and pointing out the similarities with biblical law in the introduction to his law book. And the original laws that we had in Britain came from King Molmutius around about 400 BC. And these were the laws that the Welsh people had followed, or the Britons had followed. And he used some of them, and he also used some from the Bible as well. I'll get into some of those in a minute. Do you want to make a comment on Alfred's improving the justice system and primary education, Max?
Well, just that this is a major step forward, really, in terms of the organisation of the country, where in the past, or prior to this date, or the time of Alfred, kings would have ruled pretty much as would have ruled by decree, and there would have been no law. They would have just decided what they wanted, and whatever the king wanted at any point in time would have been the law. And it shows what a forward-thinking person Alfred was, that he recognised that that wasn't an acceptable situation, that he wanted to codify the laws that had previously been previously existed, and to create a legal system that people could refer to in settling any disputes that they had, and it obviously is the origins of the British legal system, really, and an English law.
Yeah, the common law goes back to now. I mean, some of the early laws that we had before the Saxons was the sanctuary law. If you could get yourself to a stone circle, then there could be no fighting within that stone circle, and that was carried on into the churches. And if you could get yourself into the church, then that was a sanctuary area as well. That was one of the laws. Another one of the laws were that there were three things you could never take away from a man: the tools of his trade, his home, and his children, because to do that would be to unman a man. And there are collections of these. They're called the triads, and they're the ancient ancient usages of Britain, which was the laws that the Druids had, and then that the earlier Christians had after that. And they were recorded in triads so that people could easily remember them. But what Alfred did was write them all down, so that we had this law code in English rather than Latin. And he did a lot of translating work as well from Latin into English that I'll get into a bit later. But the first and the foremost of Alfred's laws was that each man must keep his oath, which I think shows the importance of that. And if you think back to the last episode, when we were talking about one of the ways that the Vikings were having such success, was that they would break their oath. They would swear on Thor that they would keep their word, they would take hostages, and then they would just slaughter the hostages and carry on raping and pillaging. So the first law that was in there was, you must keep your oath, you must keep your word. And just an interesting diversion from that, the god of oaths is actually Mithras, whose name Mitra means covenant, agreement, or contract. And the handshake supposedly originates in Mitra. And Mitra was an Aryan god. He was mentioned in the Persian Zoroastrianism, and he's also mentioned in the Vedas to do with the Hindus. And then, of course, he was also mentioned in the Roman Empire. And I do wonder if one of the reasons why he was venerated in the Roman Empire is because of this, because it was covenants, agreements, contracts keeping your oath, keeping your word. And that is absolutely fundamental to the building of civilization. So Mitra was honored by the Romans in the Roman Empire. And then when you get to the time of Alfred the Great, it's the first and most important law in his law code is that you must keep your oath. And I think that's because all of civilization is built on us keeping our word. You know, the Negroes can't keep their word. They don't understand why that is important. And, you know, you can extend that to the banking system. And if people get out loans and they don't keep their word, then the country's banking system is going to crash and you end up with things like Zimbabwe or whatever. In Britain, we have financial records of us paying back our debts, basically. So we get a lower interest rate because we keep our word. Everything, when you think about it, everything is based on keeping your oaths, keeping your word. All these offices that we have, all these civil offices, they swear to, or they used to swear to obey God, to keep to the Christian law. And if they broke their word, may God punish them. And before we started teaching people to be atheists, people took that very, very seriously. And the Jews actually changed it so that instead of swearing to obey the Christian God and obeying to obey the Christian laws, they got it changed so that they didn't have to obey the Christian laws. And I think that was the start of the rot that really set in. And nowadays, if you've got an atheist that becomes an MP or whatever, who are they swearing their oath to? Who are they frightened of that is going to punish them with eternal punishment when they die? And they're not. And yet that was the basis of all these offices that we had, all these nobles and these people that served the king. It was all based on them making an oath not to break their word, not to break the law, not to go against the Christian morals, basically. And there's nothing there anymore. There's nothing there to encourage them to keep their word. So this was absolutely central to Alfred, was that people had to keep their word. And what do you make of that, Max? Especially this Mitra thing, because I mean, I just thought of that, you know, maybe that's why the Romans were so into Mitra, because Mitra came from the Persians and the Hindus, and yet the Romans really honored him. And I think it's because he was the god of contracts and oaths. And keeping your word. And as I say, he was the first guy to make that handshake, and the handshake on a deal goes back to Mitra.
Yeah, I think that this goes hand in hand, really, with what we've just been saying about Alfred, where the codification of laws and the translation of laws from Latin into English then would mean that a very much wider number of people would actually have access to the law, would actually be able to understand the law and read the law. And in terms of the contracts and agreements and covenants made between people that are important if we're to build a civilization, the law and an understanding of the law needs to exist so that people not only make an oath, but then understand why they've made an oath, why it's important, and if the relationship they have with the other person with whom they've covenanted or made an oath, if that relationship changes, then there needs to be laws in place that then mean that the way in which they have to discharge their oath can be different from that was perhaps originally envisaged. And so what I'm thinking about here is that if you make a covenant to deal with somebody in a particular way and then they don't uphold their end of the bargain, you've got to have some remedy, and the law needs to exist. Then the law needs to be in a language that is widely understood so that the person who's on the who is the victim of somebody breaking their oath knows what remedies are available to them and can appeal to the courts to have those remedies imposed.
Well, it was actually a financial punishment that was imposed. It was wergild. And again, this is a word that most people know of, which was financial compensation based on the value of the person to society. So if you were to take a churl's life, one of the Saxons was to take one of the Norse churls' lives, they would then have to pay the Norse king the Vergild for one churl. If it was a nobleman, it would be a higher amount. And it was the same for if you broke your oath. It was the Vergild for a churl or whatever, if a churl had broken his oath. It was taken as so serious, these vows that you actually had to take to your lord. And this Vergild system of compensation, it worked both ways, because they would say, you know, if we accidentally kill a Saxon, or if we accidentally kill a Viking, you could then come to the king and you could get this financial compensation for it. So that was fairly important. And one of the ways that has a correlation to today is what they were saying there is that people are worth different amounts. And today, again, people are worth different amounts. Somebody who is of an ethnic minority and something happens to them, they can claim that the crime was racially motivated. And then the person that's being punished will get much more punishment. They'll get much more prison time, basically. And it's a similar thing to this Vergild that we had back in the 9th century, which is not an analogy many people draw, I don't think. Max, do you want to comment on this Vergild?
No, I'm not actually familiar with the Vergild principle, but I take on board what you say about different people being worth different amounts, and I can see that in a during the time of Arthur, during the time of Alfred. There would be people who would be regarded as being superior and of greater value than other people. I think that the situation now, though, isn't necessarily based upon any actual perception of superiority. It's just based upon ethnicity, isn't it? Which is sad. So, in fact, what we've got now is a perverse form of Vergild, rather than the actual principle being reintroduced in the way that it was at the time of Alfred.
Well, it also helped this idea, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth would leave the world eyeless and toothless. It also meant that if somebody was injured, say their arm got chopped off or whatever, instead of chopping off the other guy's arm that did it, there would be this financial compensation that they would have to pay based on the value that person actually had to society, what caste he was in society. So it shows we had a hierarchy there of importance, and we had castes that people were in, and that's a very similar system to the one that the Danes had. There were a lot of similarities between the Saxons and the Danes, apart from the religion, really. I mean, most of the other things were pretty similar. Another law that they had was that you could not enter another man's house to arrest him. You could only besiege it and then send notice to the king and to the man's friends. And the man's friends would then have to come and speak up for him. And the man himself would have 7 days to get his things together. And then he would have to come out. And I find that interesting because, of course, now the police can just kick down somebody's door and arrest them. But the home was seen as inviolable back then. And you would just have to surround the house and that was it. It was uncivilized to go in there. I mean, the laws of chivalry go back thousands of years, and the laws of war and the way that people are supposed to be treated, and you know, we just seem to have done away with them all. I mean, what do you make of this, Max? You know, they couldn't go into a man's house to arrest him; it was inviolable. Well,
this would have been the origin of the much spoken about principle of an Englishman's home being his castle, and I think that it is a convention that has a lot going for it, because I think that if the forces of law and order can just burst into somebody's home and take away all their possessions and arrest them, then what they're effectively doing is they're divesting that person of any means by which they can defend themselves, and that can't really be fair in my view. And if you're going to prosecute somebody, then you need to give them the opportunity to defend themselves, which means that they need to have somewhere where they can where they have refuge, and they need to have somewhere where they any papers or anything of that sort that they might have had in those days can be kept orderly, so that they can then, if they are required to go before the courts. Eventually, they can go before the courts with and make their case. Whereas if somebody's broken in and has destroyed all their papers, then it's not possible to do that.
It's very civilized, isn't it? You know, you've got 7 days in your home, and then you've got to come out, you've got to hand your weapons over, and then you've got to come to court, basically. The final one that I wanted to bring up here, and this is at the end of his law code, is holidays. And there's actually holidays stipulated for the Saxons. These days are to be given to all free men, but not to slaves and unfree labourers. 12 days at Christmas, and the day on which Christ overcame the devil, and the anniversary of St. Gregory, and the 7 days before Easter, and the seven after, and one day at the feast of St. Peter and St. Paul, and in harvest time the whole week before the feast of St. Mary, and one day at the feast of All Saints. And the four Wednesdays in the four Ember weeks are to be given to all slaves to sell to whomsoever they please anything of what anyone has given them in God's name or of what they can earn in their spare time. And, you know, there's two things to get into in that. I added it up, and it's 37 days off a year for the free men. And you compare that to what we have now. I mean, that's a lot more time off than you get now. I mean, these are public holidays, basically, what we would call today bank holidays. And they've got 37 of them, and it's based on religion. And the second thing that strikes me about this is that slaves were allowed to own property, and they were given four days off a year, and they could sell whatever they had made in their own spare time, which shows that they had spare time as well, and they could sell whatever anyone had given them in God's name. And people that were actually slaves were people that had got themselves into debt, and what they would do is, if they had a debt, they would sell themselves for a certain number of years to pay off that debt. And I think there was a limit of 7 years or 6 years, and on the seventh year you had to let the man go free. And in this way, property would remain with a certain family. You couldn't sell on land or property, things like that. You could just sell yourself as a slave to pay off these debts, and therefore lands remained under the control of families for centuries. And again, it's a very civilized system. And we're told this is the Dark Ages, and people had it really bad, but you know, they didn't. They had a lot of time off. It was written into the law itself, and even the lowest of the low, the slaves, were allowed to own things. They were allowed to work in their own spare time, and they had 4 days off. Obviously, you know, their boss could give them more days off than that if he wanted, but these were just the days that everybody had to take off. And, you know, very, very enlightened for supposedly living in the Dark Ages, I think. Do you want to comment, Max?
Yeah, I think that this again is yet another example of Alfred being very forward thinking and being ahead of his time. And perhaps the society in England in those days being far more advanced than perhaps we might have previously considered. And it's accepting the principle that if you work somebody every day, then you won't get the best out of them. You'll get more out of them if you give them time off so that they can restore their energy and restore their vigor before they go back to work again some days later. And having a certain number of days of the year off, which, as you say, there was 37 for a free man, that is not so far different from the situation where people have annual leave allocated to them today, which is you know, something which is contractual with their employers. And it, as I say, it demonstrates an enlightened view of how you get the best out of working people, basically. And, you know, even people who are slaves, even where somebody sold themselves into slavery in order to work off a debt, for example, then they're still not treated as being worthless. They're treated as if they are somebody who still has value and accorded rights based upon that.
Yeah, he saw all Christian men as having value, and all Christian men were white back then. And he even saw the Vikings as having value. I mean, when he had them at his mercy, what did he do? He baptized them. He didn't slaughter them all or say, well, I could kill you. How do you plead? Do you want me to kill you now or do you want to be my slave? Which was basically the way that the Romans did things. If they had victory in battle, you either had to accept slavery or fall on your sword. When King Alfred defeats you in battle, you can accept baptism and go and have your own land over there and have your Danelaw over there, and we'll have our Anglo-Saxon kingdom here. I mean, he was a very good man, a very good Christian, and a very good nationalist. And we'll get into more on Alfred the Great next week, I think. Just before we finish, I just want to remind people that we do have a Bitcoin wallet and we do require your donations to keep the website going. Thank you very much for coming on today, Max. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next Monday with more Aryan Britannia for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.